Welcome to KXRW's Authenticity Matters, where we examine how to live more intentional, fulfilling lives by truly being ourselves. In each episode, we will talk to guests who've transformed their lives, organizations, and the community through authentic and intentional actions. I'm your host, Jen Coyne. This month on Authenticity Matters, we're going to go on a journey into the mind and imagination of Rebecca Radcliffe. Rebecca is a fantasy fiction writer, an author of books and serial fiction for people of all ages. I'm excited to explore her life journey and to talk about how she stays true to herself while still allowing for her creativity to be influenced by others. All right. I am delighted to welcome my friend Rebecca Radcliffe. She's a writer. She's an amazing entrepreneur. She's a smart lady. She's a mom. She's all kinds of things. And we've recently reconnected, and I'm so happy to have her on the show and talk about all the work she's doing.
Well, I'm really excited to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, of course. Before we get into your background and your journey to becoming from a finance person to a writer, tell me a little bit about how you define authenticity. Since you're on Authenticity Matters, it's my obligatory question.
Well, I think authenticity is really important. I think for me, it's very important to be authentic in my work because to me, it means that I am doing work that I would want to read mm-hmm. or work that I can be proud of and show literally anyone. And also something that interests me. So rather than chasing followers or right. chasing subscriptions, I am doing the work and putting it out there and seeing who gravitates towards mm-hmm. it, because those are the people that I want to attract and keep reading the stuff that I'm doing. So being authentic means being true to what I want to do and what interests me, as well as making sure that I am trying to attract an audience that appreciates what I'm meant to
right,
do.
Right, right. It's funny because I say that lately I see things, you know, whether it's on the internet or whatever, and I go, I'm sure somebody appreciates that. It's not for me, right? Mm-hmm. And so to flip that around, it's like when you're an artist of some sort, putting something out there that feels true to you attracts the people that it's for, right? Right. And I think that that's important to recognize that what you're doing isn't for everybody, but it's for the right people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. So a little context on Rebecca, because I feel like I'm learning about her for the first time. We knew each other, 20 years ago almost?
Yep, 20 years ago.
Yeah, and recently reconnected. So we'll get into a little bit about that on her journey. Maybe she can say, like, that's when I met Jen. No. But I'm really excited because I would say we knew each other, but we didn't really know each other back then. And so we are getting to do that now, and I'm really thrilled. So tell me, where did you grow up? And, you know, what were some of those early experiences in your life?
I actually grew up in Oregon. I grew up in Southern Oregon in Grants Pass.
Okay.
And in the 70s and 80s, it was not an idyllic experience.
Mm-hmm.
We were in the middle of the decline of the timber industry.
Yeah.
And that was the main business in town. So there was a lot of upheaval
mm-hmm.
economically. And I think that that created a lot of situations for people that were not great.
Yeah. Do you have siblings?
I do. I have two older brothers.
Okay.
They're quite a bit older than me. They're 7 and 8 years older than me.
Yeah.
And so they were more solidly, you know, in the 80s
mm-hmm.
and out of the house when I was 10, I think.
Right.
And so Grants Pass is kind of a, I don't know, I think it's just a really, it was a really tough time for Grants Pass.
Mm-hmm.
And so if I think about what was going on in my house, which was kind of chaotic mm-hmm. and tumultuous, and what was going on in a lot of my friends' houses as well. There were a lot of experiences there that aren't necessarily positive, but that I can look at now and think, okay, now I understand what was going on.
Right.
And it definitely feeds into sort of the empathy that I have for my characters now, even if they're not the nicest characters.
All I want is nothing more to hear you knocking at my door.
Growing up in Grants Pass, Oregon, in an area with a lot of instability, challenges, and even tragic losses in the community, meant that Rebecca doesn't always have fond memories of her childhood, but it did shape deeply who she is today. Rebecca draws upon the resilience she acquired and the experiences she had to now navigate unstable, unpredictable, and sometimes tragic realities of life. But once you graduated from high school, mm-hmm. where did you go from there?
When I graduated from high school, I would say that I was not in the best mental health space.
Mm-hmm.
Looking back at it at the time, I was
like,
just,
who even knew? We didn't have the words or the concepts, right? We didn't talk about that stuff.
No. And so I tried to go to college.
Mm-hmm.
I went to Western Oregon and it didn't work.
Yeah.
It didn't take that time. I was depressed and I stayed in my room. And again, I didn't really have the words to talk about it or tell people or ask for help or get help. I just thought, oh, I'm failing. I'm going to drop out of college.
Mm-hmm.
And I ended up going to Virginia. And the piece of advice that I would give myself is that, you know, boys are not the answer.
Did you go to Virginia for a boy?
For a boy.
Okay.
Yes. I went for a boy and that didn't work out. But I did try college again
mm-hmm.
when I was in Virginia and managed to actually complete my accounting degree in Virginia. And
so the boy didn't work out, but the school did.
But the college did, yes. Yes.
Awesome.
Yeah. So, and I met my husband. So there was a boy in
there
Virginia.
There was a boy that did work out.
Yes. Yes. And he's still hanging around after 28 years.
Yeah, I was going to say you just celebrated an anniversary, I think, or something.
Yep. It was 28 years on March 11th.
Yeah.
In case anyone else wants to celebrate with us next year.
So what brought you back to Oregon?
When I graduated from college, we timed it. I did college when I was serious about it. I went to college in 2.5 years. And I did that because my husband was getting out of the Navy in December of 1995. So I graduated from college in December of 1995. And in terms of interesting life choices, going to college in 2.5 years is not something I would recommend. But we moved out here because I thought I had a job in public accounting.
Yeah.
And it turned out they had already done their hiring and I didn't have a job.
Ugh.
So I ended up temping for 6 months
mm-hmm.
and pestering the partner at the CPA firm until finally he just brought me and he's like, I made up a job for you. So I took the made up job and then I got a real job with them and it eventually worked out,
mm-hmm.
but I had to be pretty persistent.
Yeah, yeah. So early on, you came back here, and is it safe to say you were career-focused?
Yeah, I would say that I just really worked a lot.
Mm-hmm.
In my 20s, probably my entire decade of my 20s was work.
Yeah.
You know, either I was in college doing the crazy schedule, or I was working a lot of hours, and we share that public accounting experience.
Yep. And the working a lot in our 20s.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yep. And so a 60-hour week was pretty normal.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just, you know, run. And then there would be years where I would get to the end of the year and we go to buy our Hallmark Christmas ornament that that signified that year, and we wouldn't know what to get.
Yeah.
We did nothing but work all year. And I don't know if I would do it that way again.
Mm-hmm.
It was not balanced at all.
Right.
And I don't think it was healthy in a lot of ways. But I did the public accounting route. Mm-hmm. I got my license, mm-hmm. like you did. And then I went to Intel.
Yeah.
And that's where we met, in the accounting department at Intel.
Yep.
And that was also a grind, but not quite as bad.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. I think that they, you know, I've found that every organization will take, even the one that I've created myself, will take everything that you will give it. And so you have to set your own boundary around it. It's like I never learned about boundaries growing up. I really didn't. And that's one of the things I thought, oh, if I could tell my younger self something, it's like establish better boundaries.
Yeah.
In your life.
Yeah.
For relationships, for, you know, work life, all that kind of stuff. It's tough.
Took me a long time to learn that. I was at, after I left Intel, I went to a company called In Situ in the Columbia Gorge. And I deliberately became underemployed
mm-hmm.
because I wanted that boundary. I wanted to work 30 hours a week, and I wanted to be able to walk away from that job if I needed to.
Mm-hmm.
And by the end, I was working, you know, 45 or 50 hours a week. And
we're our own worst enemies sometimes.
Sometimes. And every time you can say, well, this is an extraordinary circumstance. This is...
Mm-hmm.
I have to do this for now, but I won't continue to. But those extraordinary circumstances just keep happening.
Yep.
So
yep.
It's the uncomfortable sensation of saying no.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And understanding that people will have opinions about that. And they might have opinions about you because of it. And letting them have those opinions without it affecting you.
Right. You can't control what somebody else is going to think about you.
Mm-hmm.
Did you feel like you were, like at the time, did you have an awareness of whether you were in tune with your authentic self, or was that not an awareness that you had back then?
I've always thought of myself as a fairly self-aware person. Mm. Like, I know I'm not everyone's flavor.
Mm-hmm.
I know that I can be challenging sometimes. I know that I'm funny. I know that I have that self-awareness. But in terms of being authentic, I really attach that to caring less about what other people think of me.
Mm-hmm.
And it really took me leaving corporate life
mm-hmm.
to be able to start exploring, you know, why do I care what that person thinks
yeah.
about me, or about what I drive, or where I went to dinner? Why do I care? And I've never been pretentious, but I did think about it.
Yeah. I've done a lot of exploration about what are the markers of, or indications of, quote unquote, success.
Mm-hmm.
And there's these societal norms about, like, what is considered to be a successful life. And I think it's really easy to get caught up in trying to demonstrate that instead of what really feels like a genuine experience and a genuine path for myself.
Mm-hmm. And I think in the time period that we're in, with the introduction of social media, just at the point where I was starting to figure that out, was really a complicating factor.
Thanks a lot.
Yeah. And I don't think that for me, social media is as much about keeping up with the Joneses as it is for a lot of other people. Mm-hmm. But even I sometimes now will see someone's fabulous vacation, or their, you know, oh, look at our second house or whatever, mm-hmm. and think about measuring against
yeah.
that.
Yeah. And thinking, like, that could be me. I could do that.
Mm-hmm. If I had continued, because I left my career 12 years ago. And decided to embark on being a full-time parent and whatever the next thing would be.
Yeah.
And had I continued working I would have all of those material things, but I wouldn't have all of the experiences that I have with my kids and the ability to, you know, work opportunistically on my writing and things like that. So I could put those things on the scale.
Yeah.
Right? All the material things and the things that I've had instead. And I still feel like I got the better deal.
Right.
But every once in a while I get that pang.
Yeah. The road not taken.
Mm-hmm.
To be just slightly, really superficially literary. So you alluded to the fact that you left 12 years ago to be a full-time mom. So was that the big driver for you leaving kind of that? You were like a controller or a CFO at a company at that point, right?
I was pretending to be the CFO of a company. Well, literally, because our CFO had gotten himself fired and we were in the process of selling the company to Boeing.
Mm.
And I stood in for the CFO. So even though I didn't have the title, because I told them, don't give me a title.
Right.
I want to be able to walk away. I was in all the meetings with all of their high-powered finance people presenting all the financial projections. And that was why I was working so much.
Right.
And I was pregnant with my son, but I had just found out. And 3 days later, we closed the deal with Boeing. And I said, I am out of here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I need to go home. I need to take care of myself. I need to see this pregnancy through. And I've never regretted that decision.
Yeah.
I've always felt like that was absolutely the right decision to make. Up until I was probably in my early 30s, I was sort of ambivalent about having children.
Right.
And then when I decided I did want children, I really wanted children. It was like,
and you're results oriented, so yes. It's going to happen.
It was a project. It was going to get done. And so we spent, it took us about 4 years to actually have a child.
Yeah.
But that was something that I desperately wanted at that point. And so I walked away from my career.
Mm-hmm.
I had the best time just being pregnant at home.
Mm-hmm.
And laying around in bed until 8:30 every day.
You're like, what's that?
Maybe I'm going to go for a walk. Maybe I won't, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I had two little dachshunds at the time. And so we would take naps on the couch together. And then we had Sam, my oldest. And it would not be exaggerating to say it was life-altering in a way that I hadn't expected.
Mm-hmm.
Because I suddenly saw everyone, like every person, as someone's child.
Mm.
And I was absorbed for a couple of years. I had Sam and then I had Vivian.
Mm-hmm.
And you have all the baby and toddler stuff and that's all you can do.
Right.
Really.
Right.
there's nothing else. And so that's what he did for a couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
I'd been in fiber arts and I'd been quilting and I was doing some commissions and stuff. When I had the second baby, that was done. There was no more time for that.
No more quilting.
Yeah.
Didn't have hands free.
No.
So then you moved on to imagining tales in your mind.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, the chocolate room.
We're storytelling today with writer Rebecca Radcliffe. We've been telling her personal story of growing up, her earlier career years in corporate life, and becoming a mom. When we come back from the break, we'll learn about stories of a different kind, those that Rebecca invents in her mind and puts to paper. I'm Jen Coyne, and you're listening to Authenticity Matters on KXRW 99.9 FM.
A big thank you to our founding partners at Morel Inc. Print and Marketing for their ongoing support of community radio. Morel Inc. is a woman-owned, union-staffed, state-of-the-art print shop that since 1993 has offered high-quality, creative, and innovative printing and marketing solutions. Morel Inc.'s experienced staff creates partnerships with their clients and uses the latest technologies to meet their needs. More information about which of Morel Inc.'s products, printing, and marketing strategies will best serve your next project and budget can be found at morelinc.com. That's MORELINK.com.
Coming up April 15th at the KXRW Ballroom, KXRW and Six Studio presents New Waves Northwest Live and Local. Join hosts JT and Ego as they showcase local musical talent. There will be vendors, snacks, drinks, with a full lineup of music and entertainment to enjoy. Purchase your tickets today online at nwnwlive.eventbrite.com. That's nwnwlive.eventbrite.com. You can also find more information about the show at kxrw.fm as well as sick-studio.com. That's sick-studio.com.
There is no life I know to compare with pure imagination. Living there, you'll be free if you truly wish to be.
Welcome back to Authenticity Matters on KXRW 99.9 FM. I'm Jen Coyne, and today my guest is fiction writer Rebecca Radcliffe. We've learned about her formative years and about the bold leap she took to leave her successful finance and accounting career when she wanted to focus on her growing family. Rebecca always stayed creative, and it wasn't too long that a new personal purpose and creative path revealed itself. Let's learn how that path became clearer and where it has taken her.
So you made the leap from finance, controller, CFO, CPA world to becoming a writer. Mm-hmm. Was that in the back of your mind, or was that just something that came out of the blue at that time?
I had written quite a bit. I had an English minor in college, and I'd written quite a few essays that mm-hmm. I had written for writing classes. But I was always writing to please the teacher,
mm-hmm.
right? Because type A. And so most of what I had written up until I was at Intel, it was about 2002, was just stuff to please the teacher.
Mm-hmm.
Stuff for work that was, you know, PowerPoint slides.
Right.
Right. But I thought about this, and I thought, well, when is the first time I wrote something and I felt like, oh, I might want to write more things?
Mm-hmm.
And it's probably at Intel. I was having one of my very weird days. Weird things happened to me. And I'd worn a pair of pants to work that really were beyond wearing to work. And at the end of the day-ish, around 4 o'clock, I wrote a small little email called The Misadventures of Rebecca's Pants. And I sent it out to just some email buddies, mm-hmm. right, at work. And I expected them to sort of chuckle and then delete it.
Yeah.
And they kept going on about it. And they started forwarding it to their friends.
Oh, Lord.
And I ended up with all these people talking to me about my pants. And it was the first time that I felt like I connected to an audience.
Mm-hmm.
And especially for people who are funny or want to be funny, the first laugh that you get is intoxicating.
Right.
And so I started sort of I had followers,
mm-hmm.
I guess, on my email distribution at Intel.
Right.
And I would occasionally just write a humorous essay or mm-hmm. something in email and send it out to my email distribution.
Right.
And then I ended up writing for The Bean Counter.
Oh, yeah. I remember that.
The finance newsletter.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote humor for The Bean Counter, which is just a funny thing to say.
Right. Sounds somewhat ironic or something. I don't know.
People actually assume that accountants don't have a sense of humor, and I have not found that to be true at all.
I think that especially if you like do taxes and stuff, you probably have the funniest stories.
Oh, yeah. And it's mostly gallows humor, right? We're fairly cynical,
right.
But some of that is
that's
best.
What it's because the accounting motto is trust but verify.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that contributes to the skepticism and cynicism of our
yes,
profession.
Absolutely. So I did that. I worked on there was a finance video. I was one of the writers for that. Mm-hmm. And I got laughs, and I was, I filed that away in the back of my brain somewhere. And when the kids were both toddler age, a friend of mine said, you know, you're really funny. You should start a blog. Because we all had to start a blog, right?
Right, back then, yeah.
Yep. And so I did, and I called it You Should Be Happy. And I wrote a few pieces on there. The one that still gets traffic is called 17 Ways to Ruin Macaroni and Cheese.
Apparently, it's putting vegetables in it.
That's one way.
Yeah.
That's definitely one. Any foreign matter at all.
Right.
But also the wrong bowl. I mean, whatever you do, there's some way to ruin it.
Yeah.
I have personally done all of those things. And so I was writing the blog, and I was getting it, you know, it was fun. Mm-hmm. It was just for fun. But I started to feel like I could write something bigger.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had a conversation with my son one night where I made a mom mistake. He was talking about beanstalks, and I thought my 4-year-old would be enchanted to hear about the giant at the top of the beanstalk.
Yeah.
And he was scared to death.
Mm.
And I found out it was because he'd planted a bean in the garden earlier. And so once I found that out, I had to figure out, how am I going to get this child to sleep? Because that's your goal every night with toddlers.
Right.
It's just like, how am I going to get them unconscious? That's all I want. And he's a reasonable little dude. And so he was like, well, maybe if it was a small giant, maybe if it was a small giant, that would be okay. And like, oh yes, I'm sure your beanstalk would grow the tiniest giant. Good night. Close your eyes. Please go to sleep.
Right.
But it stuck with me.
Mm-hmm.
And so the idea stuck with me. And as, you know, I would never recommend anyone do, I thought, well, I'll write a novel. And that's where the tiny giant
I'm like,
came
it's
from.
It's manifested into a real book sitting in front of me.
Yep. Yep. And that was the first thing I took on.
Yeah.
Was a novel.
And it's geared toward what age group?
It's a middle grade novel.
Okay.
So like a confident fourth grader to about seventh grade.
Okay.
And it's about Dan, who's our suburban hero. And Zeebel, who is a tiny giant.
Mm.
He's about 18 inches tall.
Oh, really tiny.
Really tiny. And I like to call it suburban fantasy.
So, I was going to ask you about your style. So is that how you describe your style overall, suburban fantasy?
Oh, well, my style overall is dark comedy.
Okay.
I would say that there's even some of that in here.
Yeah.
And kids either get it or they don't.
Right.
But I'd been reading a lot of urban fantasy, and I wanted to write something like that. But this is really about a kid and the nature trail, you know. And I modeled that on Dundee and the Harvey Creek Trail, which is a mile from my house.
Yeah.
So it was fun to use a real place, but populate it with all of these fantasy characters that I made up.
Right, right. I know people have fun, you know, thinking about the real place and then that imagination of the created world, which is really awesome.
Mm-hmm.
How do you, so you went from there, you have the tiny giant.
Mm-hmm.
Was that was the first thing that you published officially, or?
The first thing that I officially published was one of the picture books.
Okay.
I also have 3 picture books out that are for preschool age,
mm-hmm.
and they're called the Mood Wrangles series.
Mm-hmm.
Sally the Sad Shape was the first one.
Yeah.
And they're about emotional intelligence. They're about, there's Carl the Cranky Cone and Cedric the Silly Cylinder, and they're about self-regulation. But Sally the Sad Shape specifically, my daughter came home from school and she was sad.
Mm-hmm.
So she sat down and she drew these little cubes and she put little sad faces on them.
Mm-hmm.
And then she put a little bow on the top of the head of the little sad cube. And I was so enchanted with that that I started writing a story for it.
Mm-hmm.
Steve Ogden, who is my very talented illustrator, we were friends already, but he said, hey, you know, I could illustrate that if you want to work with me. And so we collaborated on the three picture books.
Particle man, doing the things a particle can. What's he like? It's not important. Particle man, is he a dot or is he a speck? When he's underwater, does he get wet? Or does the water get him instead? Nobody knows. Particle man. Triangle man, triangle man. Triangle man hates particle man. They have a fight. Triangle wins. Triangle man.
Technically got Sally the Sad Shape out before the novel.
Okay.
Partly because I wrote the novel 5 times.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Tell me why you wrote the novel 5 times.
The first version we call the Sitting on Logs version. My alpha readers were very honest with me, thank mm-hmm. God. And they said, this is boring. They sit on logs and tell stories.
Mm-hmm.
No one is going to read the whole thing. And for a first attempt, you know, I'll take that. And I've always taken criticism pretty well. Mm-hmm. So I went and I rewrote it until my editor, people should always work with an editor,
mm-hmm.
Even if you're self-publishing, until my editor said, this is a good story. I would read this again.
Yeah.
And that was the point where I said, oh, finally.
Finally, you got something to edit, not rewrite.
Right.
Yeah.
Finally, I can stop here and just make the minor changes that need to be made.
Right. You sort of preempted my question a little bit, but I want to go deeper on it, which is, what is the influence of external sources on, you know, folks' opinions, other material on what you do?
It's a mix of, for me, it's a mix of external influences and my own internal guiding voice.
Mm-hmm.
So I get inspiration from a lot of places.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote a whole story called Bucky LeFevre Needs Groceries based on seeing a man at the grocery store.
Mm-hmm.
Because he looked like he was a rodeo guy, but he had a glass eye. And I was like, oh, man, I have to figure out why this guy has a glass eye.
Right.
And so I went and wrote the whole story of how that happened and what happened to him afterwards and why is he at the grocery store. And so my inspiration comes from, you know, things my kids say to things that I see
mm-hmm.
to... I wrote Hansel and Gretel just based on the title
mm-hmm.
because I thought it was funny.
Mm-hmm.
And so those external inspirations come from anywhere.
Yeah.
I did sit down with my mom because I have written a lot of horror stories and inappropriate stories as well for adults. And I sat down with my mom and I said, Mom, I'm going to write things that you don't want to read.
Mm.
And I'll tell you. Mom, don't read that one.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And she said, okay, I appreciate that. And I'll trust you to tell me what I can and can't read.
Yeah.
So thinking about my, you know, what if my kids read this? Or what if my mom reads this?
Right.
Or I sort of had to head that off at the pass and just be like, I have to write what I'm going to write. And I will tell you not to read it if I think you're not going to like it. And you can read it or not.
Mm-hmm.
But
you've been warned.
You've been warned. I can't think about that while I'm writing.
Right.
And what was interesting to me about that particular issue was I talked to one of my male friends who's a writer, and he'd just written a very graphic satirical essay about a sexual topic and floated it like, hey, do you think this is funny? I said, well, it's really funny, but what are you going to do when your kids read that?
Mm.
And he said, I've literally never thought of that.
Interesting.
Yeah. And that was a turning point for me because I said, well, why am I so worried about it?
Right. Right. So like, you're like, maybe you need to move this way a little bit and I'll move closer to where you're
at. He didn't publish that one. So I think that's what we did. I think we moved a little closer together on what was, how much we have to think about who sees what we do.
Right. I mean, I think that that's always, you know, and who is affected, right, by it. I know that, you know, there's things that wacky ideas or things that I've wanted to put out there that, you know, I run everything by my business partner, too, because he's like my work husband, you know, and I have to make sure that he doesn't feel like he's going to be negatively affected by it. And then, you know, coming back to authenticity, it's like, does it give you a pit in your stomach that you would be causing somebody a problem? But also, how is that pit in your stomach as far as you censoring yourself?
Mm-hmm. Right. And the way that I deal with it with fiction is we've developed in my little creative group a place called Effetville. We'll just say that. And I write from Effetville. So if I think it's funny, it goes in. If I think it's an integral part of the story, it goes in. If I'm just being shocking to be shocking, then I think hard about it. And when I'm writing from that place, it's very freeing. And I can choose to publish it or not.
Yeah.
But with fiction, I've just said, I'm going to write what I'm going to write.
Yeah.
I think memorably, there's a story on Story McStoryface called The Going Rate.
Yeah.
My husband hates it. It's the only story of mine. He's read everything that I've written. It's the only story of mine he's ever said, I hope no one ever reads this.
Now I want to read it.
Yeah, it's out on the web, Story McStoryface, and it has narration too. I've actually read that one. So that's, even in that situation, I said, you know, I still think it's funny. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
You know, and so with fiction, that's very freeing. Because of the pit of the stomach problem, I wouldn't write a memoir.
Interesting. Yeah.
Especially not while the people who would be in it are living. You know, I see younger people writing memoirs. Like, I'm in my 20s and I'm writing a memoir.
You're like, first of all, you're not old enough.
You're not old enough to have perspective on that, to be sharing anything that anybody needs to read.
Right.
Personal and probably unpopular opinion. But also, the people in that story are still around to read what you're saying and what you think you learned from it, and how they affected you. And that kind of lack of consideration, I guess, for other people, I just couldn't do that. So.
Yeah.
I'm talking today with writer Rebecca Radcliffe. We've been talking about her shift to a writing career after a career in corporate accounting and finance. Breaking out in her self-guided direction has offered a lot of opportunity for authenticity. Yet even when we have creative control, we still operate in connection with others, requiring a balance of staying authentic to yourself while drawing inspiration from and being considerate of others. When we come back, we'll talk about Rebecca's latest projects. I'm Jen Coyne, and you're listening to Authenticity Matters on KXRW 99.9 FM.
Please join us on May 7th for the 31st year of Walk Run for the Animals. Help the Humane Society for Southwest Washington support animals in need. The route begins in Esther Short Park, heading north through historic downtown Vancouver. The event is from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. and features activities in the park, vendor villages, and route stops with giveaways from local businesses and sponsors. Details and registration information can be found at hssw.org/walk. That's hssw.org/walk.
KXRW would like to thank Kraft Cannabis for supporting our radio community. Kraft Cannabis, for 21 years and over, now has two locations in Vancouver. The newest shop is on Andreessen Road off Patton Parkway, next to Home Depot. At this location, they offer Top Shelf Tuesday, Waxy Wednesday, and Stony Sunday specials. The Mill Plain location is in the Height Shopping Center with Munchy Monday and Shatterday specials. Ordering options include online, in-person, curbside, and express window touchless pickup to better serve you. Hours and more information available at craftcannabis.com.
Welcome back to Authenticity Matters on KXRW 99.9 FM and X-Ray 107.1 FM. I'm Jen Coyne, and today we are talking about charting your own creative path with author Rebecca Radcliffe. Let's jump in now to learn about Rebecca's favorite and latest projects.
Let's talk about what your favorite project, what's your favorite writing project that you've done so far?
Oh, gosh. That's like asking me what my favorite child is, because they're all different.
Yeah.
It's like, what's your favorite character? Well, they're all, I'm attached to all of them, because if I wasn't some way emotionally attached to them, I wouldn't be able to write them with any sort of truth.
Yeah.
And so, I don't know. Right now, I really enjoyed doing Hansel and Gretel.
Mm-hmm.
It's serial fiction. It's out on Kindle Vella. And I enjoyed the process of serialized fiction, the publishing on a weekly schedule.
Right.
And it was something that I definitely just did for my own entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
And it turned into something quite a bit deeper than that. There's a good story there and a good, you know, satisfying things are learned and things
right.
are done. Right. But when I started it in the
What's the premise of the story?
Oh, Hansel and Gretel. Hansel and Gretel are abandoned mm-hmm. in the woods by their father, Mr. Mm-hmm. Woodsman. And we're all familiar with the Hansel
right.
and Gretel story.
Right.
And in the woods, they meet Gretel, the monster from Beowulf.
Okay.
And I don't want to give away too much, but Gretel eats Gretel. And
not a spoiler. That's
not
just
a spoiler. It happens fairly early on, and then Hansel and Gretel end up adventuring off together.
Okay.
Because Gretel assumes some responsibility for this boy that he's just
made abandoned.
Yeah, completely abandoned yeah. in the woods.
Right.
So it was intended to be sort of episodic to start with.
Yeah.
And so I wrote about 5 episodes of it, like, oh, they meet this person and they do this and they do that. And then thinking about it as serial fiction,
mm-hmm.
That was the perfect vehicle for it.
Yeah.
So
nice.
Yeah.
Nice.
It stretched out into a whole year of episodes.
Right. Let's talk about your latest project. What are you working on now?
What I just started is a project called The Only One Laughing, and it's set in Portland, and there's, we can talk a little bit about the challenge of setting something in a real city.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's about Elko, and he's the second son of the Harthoth clan leader. Mm. The Harthoth are a clan of cryptids that I made up because I mm-hmm. didn't want any baggage associated with them.
With like Bigfoot. Yeti or Bigfoot yeah. or something. Yeah. yeah.
And they live on Mount Adams.
Mm-hmm.
And being the second son, he has the what I call the Prince Harry problem.
Like, what do? I'm not inheriting the throne.
Right. I'm never going to assume the throne.
Mm-hmm.
But I have these responsibilities and I have some obligations. But they also leave me alone to basically do what I want.
Mm-hmm.
And what he wants to do is study humanity. And so he's kind of an anthropologist
mm-hmm.
from this other side, from this cryptid side. And there's sort of a crisis. And he decides to run from his responsibilities. Mm. and he ends up in Portland, and there's all kinds of fun things he can do in Portland. But the reason it's called The Only One Laughing is the Harthoth don't have humor.
Oh, interesting.
Yes, they don't even have a word for joke. And he, through his studies of humanity, has developed an appreciation for jokes and punchlines and humor. And so he's sort of on a quest.
Yeah,
to figure out how that works.
Right. I think you brought an excerpt to read.
I did.
From your story.
I did. This is from chapter one, episode one.
Set it up a little bit. Like, what are we... you talked about the clan of cryptids.
The clan of cryptids. And this is the very beginning of the story. So this will give you a little bit of insight into how Elko looks at humanity. And what his pastime is.
Cool.
Alice and Nathan had moved on to sniping at each other over camp setup work shares and who should be obligated to make dinner as a result. Elko found this fascinating. Who was in charge? Alice should just tell Nathan to cook dinner, he thought. She had the clan leader energy, but she was wasting all this time defending her choices. Clan leaders didn't do that. Clan leaders did not give it whether you liked their choices or not. Humans complicated simple things.
Now that I have the context a little bit more, it's interesting. You know, it sounds like you go, it allows for this external exploration of questioning why humans behave the way that they do in every situation. And you're just looking at it like, wow, we do make things complicated.
Yeah, I like the outsider's viewpoint on this.
Mm-hmm.
I like coming at it from the outsider's viewpoint. And the idea of comedy and humor and humans' ability not just to laugh, but to laugh at themselves is so important. And not to get too woo-woo about it, but I feel like that's under attack at the moment.
Mm.
I feel like people are losing that ability to laugh at themselves and understand that they don't need to take everything seriously.
Right.
And if you watch people making jokes, you know, people who make jokes professionally, it's really dangerous right now to go and make a joke that maybe crosses the line or is right on the line of what this group thinks is appropriate or what that group thinks is appropriate. And so I wanted to explore my feelings about humor, but from an outsider's point of view. It's supposed to be funny, though.
Yeah.
It's not a scientific tome about the origins of comedy in the United States.
Right.
It's a dark comedy about Elko and him bumbling around Portland.
Right, right. And he'll come back to his own tribe, his own clan, and he'll be the only one laughing.
Who knows? Who knows?
We don't know. We don't know.
That's right.
So you're doing a lot of kind of site exploration too, right? To get into the vibe of what kind of world Elko is discovering.
Yeah, and that has honestly been really fun. The last thing that I did in Portland was I went and toured Reed College. That's one of the major locations or settings in this particular story. And there's so much interesting and strange history there.
Yeah.
I was lucky enough to have a friend who could take me on a tour because she attended Reed.
Right.
And so I got some of the inside scoop and information, and it just turned out to be a perfect location for some of the things that I want Elko to do.
Yeah. You live a little ways outside of Portland, so your daily is not kind of wandering around in the core of Portland. What has surprised you as you've been investigating sort of your setting for this novel, or for this is a serial novel? Is that the right way to say it?
I think we call it a serial fiction.
Serial fiction. Okay. So as you're exploring, developing this serial fiction, what has surprised you the most about Portland today?
There are parts of Portland that I have not revisited. I did used to work downtown. I think you did too when we were in public accounting. That was a really long time ago.
Yeah.
And after the last couple of years, there are parts of Portland that I have not been back to yet. Some of like where the statues were and things like that, I think. And as a love letter to Portland, which this book, this serial fiction is intended to be, I don't really want to include some of what has happened in the last couple of years. I want to write about it the way that I remember it.
Yeah.
With the statuary still in place and the downtown still pretty unblemished.
Yeah.
I guess.
Yeah.
What has surprised me as I've been going around and just driving around and looking at stuff there are two things. One is I do not remember geographically how Portland is laid out at all.
Yeah.
And having worked in Portland for 3 years, you would think that I would still have a pretty good memory of that. But the streets are so quirky and the areas are so sort of on top of each other.
Right.
You know, you could tell me that it's in the Pearl District and I would go completely to the wrong side of Portland.
You don't have that compass sort of dialed in.
Yeah, so that has surprised me. And the other thing that surprised me is how ordinary it is still, despite some of the things that have gone on in the last couple of years. There are certainly some changes that aren't for the better, but it still felt, when I met you in the Pearl, I still felt very ordinary to go to the coffee shop and have coffee and walk back to your office. And walking around Reed was very, we got some strange looks, but I think you would get some strange looks walking around Reed any day of the week.
Right.
And so, it was just college kids and they were just so... Coming out of sort of the pandemic isolation that we had, not only being forced to be at home and do school at home and all of those things, but being in Dundee, which is 25 miles out of town.
Right.
And seeing that people were still living their ordinary lives and going about their ordinary business actually did surprise me.
You mentioned a couple times where to find your work, but I want to make sure that people can go and have the ability to check out your writing. So where can people find The Tiny Giant? Where can they find Hansel and Gretel? Where can they find The Only One Laughing and your children's books as well?
It's there's a lot of places. There are a lot of places. We have been in the throwing spaghetti at the wall stage for a while now. And so The Tiny Giant and the children's books, you can get them on Amazon. The Tiny Giant, your local bookseller can also order that one. Or you can get the audiobook on Audible. So there's lots of places to get The Tiny Giant. The serial fiction is all available on Kindle Vella, which is a new platform that they just launched last year for serial fiction specifically. And that's on Amazon.com, or you can access it through your Kindle apps on your phones or tablets.
Nice.
You cannot access it on your Kindle.
Speaking of irony, okay, I'm sure they'll get that quirk figured out.
It's a sort of pay-as-you-go system where you pay a few cents for each episode, and I don't think that the Kindles are equipped to do the token system.
Right, right.
So I'm sure they're working on
it. I'm sure.
And then if you want to read some weird short stories that I wrote, those are on Story McStoryface. That's a story project I did in 2019. And those have audio that I read myself.
Okay.
Where I asked for audience suggestions, and then I wrote short stories based on those suggestions.
Nice little call and response kind of thing.
Yeah.
And what was the name of the one that we're not supposed to read?
The Going Rate.
Okay.
My husband hopes no one reads that.
Now everyone's going to go read it. Well, it's been delightful to reconnect with you and to have you on the show and showcase the work that you're doing and the journey that you've had. So, Rebecca Radcliffe, thank you so much for being on Authenticity Matters.
Well, it's been a joy. Thank you for having me.
I want to thank my guest, Rebecca Radcliffe, for a window into her mind, life journey, and creative expressions. Her authenticity and imagination are gifts to us all. And thanks to you for joining me this month on Authenticity Matters. Before we close the show, let's hear again from the sponsors that make this show and station possible. You're listening to Authenticity Matters on KXRW 99.9 FM. But you just don't mean it. You're so insane, you're so insane. Shut up and just enjoy this feeling. Don't you love it, don't you love it? No, I ain't happy yet, but I'm way less sad. Don't you love it, don't you love it? No, I ain't happy yet, but I'm way less sad. Community Growth Radio, known as CGR, is a free online audio streaming service based out of Vancouver, Washington. CGR Radio offers news, information, and community programming that is very target-specific for the blind, visually impaired, the disabled, the 50-plus, and veterans by providing timely subjects from health, retirement, and finance that affect the above-intended audience, plus offering old-time radio, nostalgia, book magazine, and newspaper readings. If you know someone who may benefit from this kind of information and entertainment, Google CGR Radio, that's CGR Radio, or call 360-583-7748.
A big thank you to Vancouver's own Kagan's Theatre for supporting our radio community. Our historic Kagan's Theatre has a long tradition of showing movies for our community, 85 years. Kagan's currently features first-run big studio and art house films along with classic movie revival. Check out their live events, and you can even book the theater for a private party or public event. Go to kagansthéâtre.com to see how you can rediscover the joy of going out for movie night again. Showtimes, booking information, and more at kagansthéâtre.com.
Join me next time to hear more authenticity journeys on Authenticity Matters. This is KXRW 99.9 FM.